The mission of the FBI, as stated by the FBI, is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. And so if you think about it that way, that's where I think, you know, I think you can find alignment between what law enforcement wants and what a lot of the tech and computer science and engineering community thinks about too, because the goal of the FBI then is to protect the American people from malicious cyber actors too. And so the Bureau and other law enforcement agencies should not want it to be the case that there's insecurity in the cyber realm.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 8th, 2019. Encryption and going dark splashed across the headlines in the wake of the 2015 San Bernardino attack, when the FBI and Apple went to court over access to an encrypted iPhone recovered from one of the perpetrators. Since then, little progress has been made on the encryption issue. Privacy advocates and technology companies are locked in a stalemate with law enforcement, with the former arguing that encryption is vital for cybersecurity and privacy, while the latter has argued that law enforcement agencies need some way to lawfully access encrypted data in certain criminal or national security cases. A working group set up by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Princeton University is endeavoring to break this impasse, or at least crack it, with a new paper entitled Moving the Encryption Policy Conversation Forward. Benjamin Wittes sat down with two members of the working group, Susan Landau of Tufts University and Jim Baker of the R Street Institute, to discuss the paper, the goals of the group, and how to reconcile seemingly incompatible views on encryption. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 459, Jim Baker and Susan Landau on Moving the Encryption Policy Conversation Forward.
So before we talk about your paper, I wanted to get a sense from both of you of the kind of evolution and maturation of the politics of encryption. It has been a sort of highly contested issue between law enforcement and the technology community and civil libertarians for a long time. Over the last few years, there seem to be a bunch of efforts to kind of bridge the gap, of which this is clearly one and a kind of particularly interesting example of one. Why now? Why are we sort of at this point in the encryption discussions suddenly starting to sort of join hands and kind of reach across the gap?
I think actually reaching across the gap began already happening almost 25 years ago, 20 years ago, when we saw the change in encryption policy under the Clinton administration, right at the end of the Clinton administration, with the change in export controls, which permitted the export of computer and communications equipment with strong encryption, with some small exceptions. I expected a market to develop right away. It didn't for another dozen years or 11 years or so, but that was one shift. Maybe Jim wants to say more, and then I'll say some more after that.
It's a good question, Ben. I'm not sure I have a concise answer for you. It was never as acrimonious behind the scenes as it seemed in public, that the FBI in particular is what I can speak to the best, and even DOJ, actually had better working relationships with the tech companies than one would have normally thought. Why now exactly? I don't know. I mean, Dennis McDonough pulled together this group, and I mean, you did have people in the Obama administration who were willing to try to work together, who did not agree on a lot of these issues, but who were committed to trying to solve the problem and were willing to recognize that there were two sides. Each side was willing to recognize that there was another perspective.
So one of the things that I am curious about is that this paper comes out right around the same time that the Attorney General gives a pretty belligerent speech in which he kind of announces a new push on, it's not clear what he means to do exactly, but he does seem to be, you know, spoiling for an encryption fight. And this is kind of a lower the temperature, kind of look for common ground sort of paper, precisely as the Justice Department seems in a, you know, take the gloves off and hit industry hard kind of posture. I'm curious whether, Jim, your sense of it is that, in fact, the relationship is still better than it seems from the outside, or whether this is actually a deterioration of the relationship that's happening kind of even as you guys are trying to figure out how to make things work better?
I guess I would answer that in a couple of ways. So day to day, the people that need to interact with each other from a law enforcement perspective with the companies, those relationships work on are effective on both sides, in my opinion, because law enforcement has to serve process on a variety of companies, and companies have to comply with it unless they disagree and they have a different view of the law. And so when they disagree, they make their views known, and you know, sometimes we end up in court, as happened in the Apple dispute from 2016. So there's that going on. I do worry that the sort of the tone of the Attorney General's speech at various points indicates that the relationship is not going as well as I would hope. I mean, I think there is interest. There has been interest on both sides over the years by some players, some individuals, to try to find common ground. So that is possible, and that's what actually this report was about, trying to find common ground by people who wanted to look for it, right? You have to want to look for it and seek it out and see if it's there. If you approach the debate that, you know, sort of you need to get what you need and you demand it, then it's just not going to happen because it's not easily attainable. And that's what, you know, having worked on this issue for many, many years myself, you know, it's just a very, very hard issue to tackle. It is technically complex, and it has many variables and factors that you have to consider, and it's hard to reconcile all those simultaneously.
Susan, how would you describe, you know, before you go look for common ground on stuff, you have to sort of figure out, like, what's the unbridgeable part? Or maybe you figure out the unbridgeable part by figuring, you're trying to bridge everything and figure out what can be bridged. But when you think about what's the part of this discussion that is the most resistant to resolution, even by people who most want to resolve it? And a huge amount of this paper, just in terms of the number of the pages of it, are actually trying to identify, all right, focus on this, not this, focus on this, not this, in an effort to get to the parts that you can actually bridge. So I want to start by lopping off the stuff that is hardest to bridge, because I don't want to spend time talking about it in this conversation. So what's the irreducible core of the dispute where law enforcement and cybersecurity engineers and tech people and civil libertarians simply will not see eye to eye?
So that partially depends on where you're looking from. If you're looking from the UK, you get a different view than you get when you're looking from the United States. The UK has been pushing on what we call data in motion communications, whereas US law enforcement has been pushing on data at rest, stored data, whether it's in mobile devices as we address on the phone or elsewhere. From the tech side, which is where I have planted my feet all my career, from the tech side, we're most concerned that a solution not create risk to people at large. That is, the solution should be any solution that is part of law and part of technology should be only focused on those people for whom there is lawful reason to go into their devices or their communications. I found that one of the aspects of this report that I'm quite pleased with was that separation down a path into the issues that we felt were most technically feasible, with the argument saying, look, if we can't even get to a solution here, then the bigger problem is insoluble. So here we have isolated one particular case that we think may be resolvable. Now let's try and look at it. But look at it first, if it can be resolved, before we rush to law. And I thought all of those different choices, let's narrow to a single case and let's say, let's explore first whether it's technically feasible before we rush to law, were both very good outcomes from the report.
So you are, as you say, a technical person, and my question is, You're a technical person who has an unusual degree of engagement with law enforcement over time. So I want to ask you and Jim this question in a sort of reciprocal fashion, because he's a law enforcement person who has an unusual degree of engagement with technical people and industry over time. So what is your bottom line equity that you can never really compromise on without feeling like something really important is going to be lost?
I suspect Jim and I are going to agree here. It's in the report, and it's something that I think everybody in the room agreed on. So for me, my bottom line is don't create insecurity. Don't push a law solution. Don't push a technical solution that raises insecurity. And that's my bottom line.
Jim, how about you? When you think about it from a law enforcement and specifically from a perspective of somebody who, you know, in one way or another has to, you know, run or supervise a lot of investigations, what's the core law enforcement? Obviously, you want us access to as much stuff as you can get under the right circumstances, but what's the irreducible core of the law enforcement equity here?
Well, I see that sort of two different ways. There's one way is how I think about it now, and another way is sort of what's the core of the problem that law enforcement has. And just, you know, to summarize it, it's pretty widely known. But the core of the problem is that law enforcement is conducting authorized investigative activity. When it needs to, they want to follow leads that are logical. And so sometimes that involves accessing stored data. Sometimes it involves accessing data in motion. Sometimes it involves accessing metadata about communications. And so when law enforcement agents and officers go and get what they are required to get under the law and under the Constitution, such as a warrant, for example, or a Title III order, and they serve it on the company, they cannot, in many instances, actually access the content, the unencrypted content of the communications, in order to find out what the suspect is doing. And so that's the core of what law enforcement wants, which is when they serve appropriate legal process in compliance with the Constitution and laws, that they should have access to that content in an unencrypted way, because otherwise it negatively impacts the investigation, right? You can have a debate about how bad that impact is, and we've talked about that many times in the working group and so on, but that's the core. But, I mean, let me just step back for a second, right? Because the mission of the FBI, for example, let me focus on the FBI. The mission of the FBI, as stated by the FBI, is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. And so if you think about it that way, that's where I think, you know, I think you can find alignment between what law enforcement wants and what a lot of the tech and computer science and engineering community thinks about too, because the goal of the FBI then is to protect the American people from malicious cyber actors too. And so the Bureau and other law enforcement agencies should not want it to be the case that there's insecurity in the cyber realm, because that just is bad for so many Americans. And so I think if you step back and think about it that way, then it actually makes the problem, I think, a bit clearer, but also harder, because it's hard to find a technical solution that adequately achieves the objectives of law enforcement and robustly protects cybersecurity.
Law enforcement has a interest in perfect background cybersecurity that gives way perfectly and seamlessly when it has lawful process to acquire a certain set of pieces of information. And those two objectives are obviously in indelibly conflict with one another.
They're certainly in tension with each other. And right. And so the part of the debate becomes how much risk can or should the system tolerate on one end or the other, right? Because if you create certain mechanisms, perhaps, to gain access to data that's currently encrypted, you're introducing risk from a cybersecurity perspective, and exactly how much risk are you introducing? And then you have a debate and discussion about that.
All right. So, Susan, tell us about this group, this was put together by Carnegie and Princeton. And how did it come together? And I mean, obviously, the objective is somewhat obvious from the questions that we've been talking about so far, but spell it out. Who put it together and to do what?
So Dennis McDonough, working with Kate Charlotte. Dennis McDonough was President Obama's chief of staff. Kate Charlotte, who at the time was heading the Carnegie Group on cybersecurity, she has since moved to Google, and working with Alice McGillivray, who had been working at the White House, and Ed Felton, who's a professor at Princeton, who'd also been at the Office of Science and Technology Policy. They looked at this issue, which is a very knotty problem in security and in investigations, and they thought that they could pull together a group of people who were able to talk to one another, who weren't going to be absolutists. And I would say that from the start, the discussions were quite fruitful. There were people mostly from on the ex-government side. They were from the Obama administration. We had representation from NSA and CIA and Homeland Security, that is, people who were no longer in the government. But we also had representation from the civil liberties and civil society sector. We had some computer scientists. But everybody in the room was in the position of, let's see if we can move forward on the discussion. And one of the notable things about the meetings is that there was no grandstanding. Somebody would make a point, and if it wasn't picked up, we moved on. It wasn't that the person came back and made the point again and again. And so it was very successful in that way.
So did you have screaming Twitter fights with each other in which one side said you're helping the terrorists win and the other side said you're breaking the internet?
On the contrary, we sometimes had people from what you would say was one side piping up and saying, you know, if we phrase it this way, we're not really taking into account the issue that you've just raised, pointing to somebody from the other side. No, it was quite the opposite of screaming Twitter frights. This was really a group that was trying to move forward in a very productive way.
All right. So, Jim, what's the magic bullet that you guys came up with?
There's no magic bullet. Unfortunately, we did not come up with a magic bullet.
It was a trick question.
Yes, I know. And we said that, I think we said that explicitly or some words to that effect, because it's a hard technical problem. And so let me back up, right? So you're trying to simultaneously do many things that are in tension with each other. You're trying to achieve the objectives of the public. We refer to them as public safety officials, right? So that includes law enforcement, other national security authorities, intelligence collection, all that. So public safety, people trying to protect the public. So you're trying to reconcile what they need from an investigative perspective, which is as much access as is possible with lawful process. At the same time, as we've talked about, you need to have cybersecurity for communications, because there's a lot of malicious cyber actors out there, and you need to protect important systems and communications and data from those bad people. Then you want to make sure that you don't do anything to inhibit innovation in the technology sector, to make it onerous and difficult and harder for American companies in particular to compete in a global marketplace. So you want to do that. You also want to make sure that these systems can work in environments overseas where people are, you know, under the heel basically of authoritarian governments, and so need protection from that. And so you're trying to reconcile all of these things simultaneously. So we didn't come up with a silver bullet because we don't know what that is yet. Having said that, what we tried to do then, as Susan was saying earlier, is to focus our efforts and then try to focus the debate generally on what we think is potentially a valuable area to focus on where there might be a technical solution that might adequately balance all of these different equities. And that's where we focused on, in particular, data at rest on devices that the government has lawful possession of.
And Susan, let's break out some of the technical distinctions that most people are familiar with, the distinction between data at rest and data in motion, but some of our listeners may not be. And one of the things this paper does is it works through a decision tree of what to focus on, trying to exclude the hard stuff and focus on the stuff that is more amenable to solution. So, Susan, walk us through the decision tree that brings you to a focus on, you know, device data at rest.
Sure. So we first started by separating the problem into domestic law enforcement versus foreign intelligence. And we decided to focus on domestic law enforcement in part because it has a harder problem, the problem of proving things within a court as opposed to providing intelligence. And in part because there are different skill sets and capabilities available to the SIGINT community, the signals intelligence community.
And if I could just interject, and a different legal regime applies in both of those contexts, right? So,
absolutely.
The spies get to do things that the law enforcement people don't get to do. They have an immense set of technical resources available to them. And by the way, we are a little bit less solicitous of their plight insofar as, you know, law enforcement has to operate under a much more restrictive regime, and we'd sort of depend on them for very immediate public safety issues for the general public every day
right.
in American cities.
Right, of course, is operating outside the United States, whereas domestic law enforcement is operating in the United States, and its targets are people within the United States in general.
So focus on law enforcement, not intelligence. Idea number one.
Right, but just to add to that, though, recognizing. And the report does recognize that, you know, an organization like the FBI is in a different place, but it's because it has multiple roles, national security, law enforcement, domestic law enforcement, that having nothing to do with foreign intelligence or national security as well. So the FBI is in a very unique place in this ecosystem. But nevertheless, we were focused on the quote unquote law enforcement aspects of this, mainly thinking about what's happening in the United States in cases where there has been a crime and where the predominant focus is on criminal activity.
So just to put a table pound on that point, when people think of this, they first of all conflate a lot of intelligence and law enforcement interests. But secondly, and I think critically, they are thinking about federal interests, not local law enforcement. Is it fair, Jim, to say that the core of the problem from a law enforcement perspective is not the FBI, which has, you know, it's got a problem in the going dark world, but it's nothing compared to the problem of some local police department that doesn't have a lab, that doesn't have any of its technical resources, and that, you know, is dealing with the same technology, these, you know, everything kind of Apple can throw at the security of a phone is showing up in a kind of routine murder case.
I mean, look, I'm not going to say that the FBI is not part of the core of the problem. I certainly thought it at the time, and I still think that it is. But having said that, your point is a good one, that the Bureau has more technical and financial resources than many state and local authorities across the country. And so, yes, it is still a problem, but we have more resources to try to deal with it.
So, point one, focus on law enforcement, not intelligence. What's point two?
Point two is focus on what we call data at rest rather than data in motion. So data in motion is communication. And the reason we said we were going to focus on data in rest was in part because that's where U.S. law enforcement has said that its biggest concern is. But it's also because of technical issues. The way we have developed the technology we've developed to protect data in motion has a very complicated use of the encryption keys that enables using a different key each time you do a communication. What that means is that if somebody breaks into your system, they're not able to decrypt the old communications. And that provides tremendous security. To accommodate the kind of thing of exceptional access would destroy that kind of particular protection, among others. And so for both the reasons that law enforcement has been focused on mobile devices and because of the issue of what we call forward secrecy, we focused on data at rest.
Okay, so we're lopping off sections of it here. We're not dealing with the foreign intelligence side. We're dealing with the law enforcement side. We're only dealing with data at rest, not messaging. That is like what's stored on people's drives or on people's devices. But we're actually not focused on all devices here. So, Jim, what's exclusive step number four?
Well, we decided to focus on mobile phones because that is a particular problem today because of the how many people use these phones around the world. And, you know, the bad guys use them too, and there's lots of information on them. And so it's a highly, from an investigative perspective, it's something that would be very useful if we could figure out how to deal with this problem. And we decided to lop off some of the more complicated issues involving desktops and laptops and things of that nature, and then in particular cloud storage that might be encrypted. So they just raise other – and Susan can explain this better than I can for sure – but they raise other technical complicated issues. And so we thought, let's just focus on – in this case, this really is at the core of what the – what I think the law enforcement – across the board is most worried about when you're talking about stored information, data at rest.
So here you have a murder victim. You want to get into her phone to see who she was in contact with before she was murdered, or you've got the San Bernardino killers. They're dead, but you want access to their phones to see who abroad, for example, they may have been in touch with, right? These are data at rest on phones.
Somebody,
right?
Exactly. Somebody involved in a drug gang or some other type of violent gang, and you get their phone and it's locked, and how do you get into it?
Okay, but Susan, we're not focused on all data at rest on phones because there's a number of different ways to break encryption on a phone, right? And you
We're not focused at all data at rest on phones because some of the data, for example, the kind that Jim mentioned about who have they communicated with, that kind of communications metadata is available at the carrier and in other places. But we're interested in their contact list. We're interested in photos they may have taken on their phone. We're interested in the calendar if the calendar is only on the phone and not shared in the cloud. So there's specific data that's on the phone that we're quite interested in. Or that law enforcement is quite interested.
And just keep in mind, Ben, so like, for example, when you have a situation where some of what we've lopped off about data in motion, right, so the data in motion that is very hard to access because it's encrypted, if you get into the phone, you may actually be able to read the contents of it because there it is on
you
the
can
phone.
You can open up somebody's signal.
Exactly. You can open up the app and there it is.
All right. But you're not interested in all schemes to get into at data at rest on a device, on a phone. Susan, you distinguish between two here and focus only on one of them. Tell us about that.
Sure. So if you remember back in the Apple FBI case about San Bernardino, the FBI sought to have Apple create a code update that would undo the security protections of the phone. And Apple was unwilling to do so, and then the FBI did get into the phone another way. There are two ways that make it possible to access encrypted encrypted data on a phone. One is through the model of code updates, and the other is through escrowing the keys for encryption.
And just to break that out and explain that for a minute, escrowing the keys is like, you know, what people think of as sort of a backdoor, right? Or the keys to unlock the encryption is somebody other than the user somehow would have access to them, then law enforcement could make use of that. Whereas the code update is literally going to Apple and saying, you know, send an update to Wittes's phone that will enable us to break in.
Correct.
And you're focusing only on the escrowed keys model here.
Right. And we rejected the code update, both because it creates insecurities in various ways, and also, and I think for many of us, it was the larger reason, the bigger reason, was the concern that if code updates were a way of rolling back security, that many people would choose not to do code updates. And code updates is one of the important ways we've improved security for mobile phones, for laptops, for all types of electronic devices. The updates to Word and to Chrome and to, well, Chrome happens automatically, but the updates to all the software and to the device, having people accept it, enroll in automatic updates, is really important for security. And if we saw people beginning to decline updates, we would be moving into a model of less security, not more. So we opted for the escrow system.
Can I just jump in on that as well? Because I do feel strongly about that point, in strong agreement with exactly what Susan just said. Because this idea has been proposed many times within certain elements of the law enforcement community. And I would just beg them to think about that in a different way, because the security of the ecosystem of the digital ecosystem depends so heavily on people accepting and trusting these updates. And if some number of people were to start to believe that the government was sort of giving some special sauce coming along with these updates, I think that would be very perilous for the system. And so it sounds, to many people, I think it sounds like a very easy way to get something, we'll do it on a targeted basis. We'll only, only Ben's phone will be the one that gets the special update, and we'll have a warrant for it and authorization and so on. But if it were to come out that this is a methodology that the law enforcement was using to download onto devices surveillance capability, I think that would undermine, I'm quite concerned that that would undermine confidence and have the negative implications that Susan just described. So I really think it's important for folks on the law enforcement side to think deeply about that before they advocate that as a methodology for implementing surveillance.
All right. And so then the final element of the decision tree is that not all escrowed keys are created equal, right? You can escrow keys in a thumb drive in your back pocket or in a vault at Fort Knox, or there are ways to escrow keys on the device itself. You guys focus only on the on-device version of that. Why is that, Susan?
So you said you can escrow the keys on the device, and you certainly can. The question that we have, and the reason we keep saying there might be a solution, is can you do so in a secure way? But let me go back to the three different ways you proposed. If you escrow them on a thumb drive, that doesn't do law enforcement very, very much good, because unless they have the thumb drive, they're exactly where they were before. And there's no reason why they would have easy access to the thumb drive. So do you escrow them at a provider? And the problem with escrowing them at a provider, whether it's Apple or Google or some phone company, is you've now created a very rich target for somebody to go after. An interesting case of that, or an analogous case of that, is that maybe 8 or 10 years ago, the Chinese government broke into Google and found who were the targets of wiretap orders. And it appears that what they were looking for is which of their nationals had been exposed as spies and the U.S. government was already onto them. Now, the point is that if you make the escrowing of the keys off the device, you have a very rich target for a nation state to go after, or somebody with lots of money. You could imagine a drug dealer with lots and lots of money trying to corrupt whoever it is that holds the keys to his device to find out if he's being targeted or who else is. So that's why we opted for on device. But I'll emphasize again what Jim said, which is there might be a technical solution, and we then have to look whether or not it balances the equities. So we didn't say that is the solution. We said it might be one.
All right. So we've now narrowed the field really dramatically. When people say encryption, they think they're talking about, something specific. And I think your point is they're actually talking about a huge number of general subjects. And if you want to get a group of complicated thinkers with diverse equities in this to agree on something, you got to narrow the field. You've gone through like 6 or 7 steps of field narrowing to get to domestic law enforcement, mobile phone data at risk using key escrows that are located on the device. What does that get you in the way of agreement? If you focus it that narrowly, what do you come up with?
Well, just real quick, though, also, it's devices that law enforcement has, for whatever reason, physical control of, right?
Right. And sorry, I forgot that step.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's important, too, because we're not talking about some type of remote access that raises other technical issues. Again, we were trying to simplify it to these situations where law enforcement, either through a search warrant or a search incident to arrest or some other mechanism, has obtained physical access to the phone so that everybody knows that. It's not trying to, you know, sneakily download something onto the phone, either directly or remotely or something like that. So again, it's just an effort to try to make the use case as streamlined as possible and to take away as many technical issues that would add layers of complication. So you could kind of get to the question of whether there is actually a technical solution that would appropriately balance all the equities that we talked about a little while ago.
With Jim's point about having the phone in their hands, that decreases the risk that the type of solution would then be available for somebody else to break in remotely to someone's phone. They'd actually have to have the phone. And whether you're preventing criminal elements or nation states from attacking phones, having the phone in their hand in order to open it was crucial in protecting the security of the solution.
All right. So you get all of that narrowing. You get a diverse group of people who are all of good faith, have very different perspectives, and really want to work together to bridge the gaps. What does it get you, Susan? What do you guys come up with on that very narrow but very important set of questions?
What we get to is we say, don't take the whole encryption problem because you can't solve it. You want to solve it? Here's the one that seems the most fruitful. Think about, are there solutions to this one? Don't legislate yet, but see whether or not there are potential technical solutions. Examine them carefully. See that they don't create security risks. If it does seem that there are potential solutions, then you can think about legislation. Then you can think about other pieces of the problem. So it says, here's what you need to consider when you're tackling the encryption problem, and here's how you might go about resolving it.
Yeah, just to amplify, because Ben, our objective at the start was not to solve the encryption problem. It was to advance the discussion and advance the debate in a more constructive way, to turn a corner and point, you know, the country and people struggling with these issues in a perhaps more productive way, as you were saying earlier, to narrow the field and point people in the right direction. We're laying the groundwork for future work is the basic idea.
And so the essential argument is not we've narrowed the field to this point and solved it. The essential argument is if you want to look at a solution, look for a solution, start by narrowing the field to this point and by focusing on the technical capacity and plausibility first rather than on the policy first. Is that fair?
Well, I think it's best to say you're trying to focus on technical problems where there might be a solution that is susceptible to a policy resolution as well. Right, so that you might be able to crack. We were trying to look for, at least this is my perspective. Susan may disagree. We're trying to look for a technical area where you might be able to legislate effectively and balance all the competing equities, because there might be if there's going to be a technical way to do something about encryption, it's probably going to be in this area. So, and I'm not the scientist, Susan is, but like to me, it sounds, you know, I thought about, well, this is like trying to advance a field of science. You're trying to make progress in a positive direction, not necessarily resolve everything magically all at once.
Right. But I did have the impression that there was a sort of specific kind of philosophical order of operations. First, narrow it to this space, then look for technical solutions. Then when you have a technical approach that operates within the constraints and performance metrics that you've decided upon, then develop policy out of that. Am I misunderstanding that, Susan?
Slightly, but only slightly. It may look like that's where we started. In fact, that's where we ended. So we started by talking about technical solutions and whether there were technical solutions. And what became clear during the discussions were that you can't talk about the whole soup. You have to talk about particular pieces of it. And if you're going to talk about particular pieces of it, the technical problems remain hard, which means you shouldn't start with policy and law. You should first see if there's a potential solution. Having said those two pieces, narrow the problem and then first see if there's a solution, you get to the kind of decision tree and the logic that says, let's see if there's a technical solution for this particular problem that seems most amenable to having a technical solution. If there is, then you can consider legislation. And if there isn't, the bigger problem seems even less amenable. So it was by starting with the big, we narrowed to the small.
It's my view that once you know what to write the legislation about, it's not that hard to do. So I think part of the problem, you can write lots of different types of legislation that are broad or very narrow, and the broad legislation potentially sweeps up, you know, the branches of the tree that we've lopped off here. And so, you know, from my perspective, we're trying to get to a point where, we know, yes, this is the answer. And so the legislation should be written in a way to only focus on this piece, to provide us a legal mechanism for law enforcement to obtain authorization for this type of thing, and then, you know, push that through Congress. And then, look, I mean, we're not saying never try to address the other branches of the tree that we've lopped off here, but let's start with something where we might have progress, and maybe you can find something that is novel and interesting that nobody thought of before, and maybe it's applicable in these other areas as well, and then you can turn to those. But don't try to, you know, as people frequently say, don't try to boil the ocean. Let's try to focus on a pot of water that we can actually do something about.
We're boiling the ocean just fine.
Well, maybe. You know,
all right. So I want to come back to Bill Barr's speech and kind of end there. He is doing exactly the opposite of what this paper recommends, as I understand the speech. I mean, he basically comes back to, we think all communications should be technically possible to decrypt, and we should be able to access all of it with appropriate process. And the burden is entirely on the companies to achieve that. And by the way, we reserve the right to go to Congress and require that. And we reserve the right to litigate further under existing law, a la San Bernardino 2. The paper opens with a avoid absolutist positions. And one of them is that, or at least one of them is something pretty close to that. And so I'm curious, Susan, first you and then Jim, I want to come to you afterwards because you spent so much time in the Justice Department. What would be a constructive position for the Attorney General to take at this point, given everything that you guys have said in this paper and given presumably what he feels are some pretty exigent law enforcement needs for information?
I see two different ways. Two pieces of response. One is to say, okay, these people with experience in law enforcement, national security, technology, civil society, civil liberties, say that the direction of looking at mobile devices, mobile phones at rest with an escrow key on, with the keys escrowed on the device in the hands of law enforcement, that's a potential direction. We're willing to fund some research. We'd like to see other organizations fund research to see whether or not there's technical solutions that can do this. We'd like to see this done within a relatively short time, a few years, not decades, but years. And we want to see that direction. If we don't see efforts that way, we will come back with more requests, but we'd like to see that. We understand that's the most fruitful direction. The other piece is something that we didn't discuss much in the paper. I can't remember if we mentioned it at all, But there are other pieces of low-hanging fruit. CSIS, for example, has a report that discusses other ways that law enforcement capabilities on about getting information that is locked into or on about in digital devices can be improved. That is the capabilities of law enforcement. And I would like to see at the same time that the Attorney General says we want to push on getting data off devices, that he also says, and we're going to greatly improve not only the capabilities of the FBI, but also its ability to share skills and knowledge with state and local, because state and local, as Jim has said, really are short on those capabilities.
So, Jim, you were advising the FBI director when he came to Brookings and announced the big Going Dark initiative a few years ago. If you were advising the Attorney General now, what would you have advised him to say in that speech?
Well, so that's a much more complicated answer, and I'm actually working on a piece for Lawfare that addresses that, so I'll leave that off for the moment. But in terms of the report, I guess the report that Susan and I worked on, what I would say would be then let's try there. These outside experts are recommending that this is the area to focus on. Okay, let's form a working group and let's us in the Department of Justice engage with these outside experts and industry and start in this area and say, okay, I, the Attorney General, would like a report in 6 months about whether we agree that this is feasible and to try to make some progress in this regard. And, you know, maybe fund some of our own experts within the FBI and elsewhere in the government to try to tackle this problem to see if we can come up with any technical solutions that we could put forward to try to do this, knowing that they probably won't be perfect, but putting things from a technical perspective on the table, actual technical proposals, because it's a more manageable area to focus on, to follow what we suggest in the report, focus on that area, focus your technical energies in the area. And again, 6 months, try to make the report. I agree with Susan that it's probably going to take much, much longer to actually come up with a technical solution that might do the trick. But the Attorney General could ask for a technical report within 6 months about whether the department agrees with us and whether the technical experts inside of the government think that there might be something that they could put on the table.
So what happens to this group now? Do you guys now start working on a different part of this decision tree, or is the group done, or is there some other area that you guys mean to focus on?
I think that remains to be seen. We have been quite pleased, I would say even delighted, by the progress we made and the ability to talk across the table. And we may look at some other issues. We haven't decided that yet.
Yeah. The encryption, having worked on encryption for years, it's exhausting. It's such a hard problem. And a lot of the people in the group have been working on it for a long, long time. And so I think people are open-minded to work on things in the future, but there's not a current plan to do something at this particular moment. But look, I mean, I think one of the benefits of this is that a lot of people with a lot of different perspectives came together and were able to work something out that is moving the debate forward, right? I mean, I think so. It was successful in that regard that we were able to move the debate forward in a positive way and build relationships in the process.
The paper is called Moving the Encryption Policy Conversation Forward, and it is from the Encryption Working Group, two of whose members, Jim Baker and Susan Landau. Thank you both for joining us, and the paper we will attach to the show notes of this episode of the Lawfare podcast, but you can probably also just get it by Googling the name of the paper. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jim Baker and Susan Landau for coming on the show. If you have a second, please share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag, rational security swag, and more at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.